Good morning. How is everyone? Good? Well, welcome. We are in the middle, or a little past the middle, of a two-day session. If it feels a little different here this morning, I think that's why. There are about 20 of us, maybe a few more than 20, who are doing a retreat. We were here Friday night for a couple of hours, and then all day yesterday from early in the morning until about 9, and then today we'll be finishing up about 4 o'clock. So we do these retreats in silence for the most part. We may talk a little bit if during work period or something like that, and we have Dharma talks and announcements and that kind of thing. But mostly it's in silence. And because it's in silence, there won't be any tea or social time after the talk today. And thank you for supporting us by being okay with that. I'm assuming you're okay with that. And please come back next week when we'll have a chance to talk and get to know you a little better. So yesterday, during the retreat, I talked a little bit about the third ancestor in China. And I'm going to talk about him a little more today. And his name was Jianji Songsan. And yesterday, basically, I just talked about one line that he wrote. And I will get back to that line today, but I would like to provide a little bit of background, talk a little bit more about who he was. So Songsan, one of our ancestors, when we talk about the Buddha ancestors, this is one of them. This is a name that we chant on Saturday mornings when we chant the names of all the members of this lineage in this supposedly unbroken line of teachers, starting with the Buddha and all the way to today. And he's known as the 30th patriarch because he was the 30th teacher after the Buddha. And in China, he's known as the third ancestor. Bodhidharma was the first ancestor in China, and then Daizu Huike, and then Songsan. And he died in 606, so a little over 1,400 years ago. And his name is spelled S-E-N-G-C-A-N, and it's pronounced Songsan. And there are only a few things known about his life. I found a few sources on him. Apparently, he lived in a time of political persecution when the government in China was persecuting Buddhists, severely suppressed them. The government was closing temples. It destroyed written records, destroyed monuments, defrocked much of the clergy, to the point that Songsan was forced to live inconspicuously among the general population, basically in hiding for much of his life. At the end of his life, he was able to teach. Things loosened up a little bit. And this comes from the transmission of the lamp by the Japanese monk Keizan, which some of you are familiar with. And that was written much later. Andy Ferguson, in the book Zen's Chinese Heritage, says that there were so few records, there are so few records left of that time, many of them were destroyed, that people doubt whether he actually existed. So we don't really know. And another scholar, Heinrich Dumoulin, in Zen Buddhism, A History, says a little bit about him personally. He was known for his friendliness, magnanimity, and gentleness. And the first story we have about him, he first kind of shows up in the record when he meets his teacher, Daizu Huike, the second ancestor. So he comes to the temple, he appears before Daizu Huike, and he does prostrations. He presents himself to the teacher and says, basically, please teach me. And he was a lay person at this time. He was over 40 years old, which is good to know because it means you don't have to start learning Buddhism when you're 20 and practice it for 50 years, although that might help. You don't have to do that in order to gain a deep understanding of Buddhism. You can start when you're 30 or 40 or 60 or 70. And here's the story. So Songsan comes to the teacher and he says, "My body is infected with leprosy, I beg you, O priest, to cleanse me of my wrongdoing. So, I have leprosy, please help me. This gives me a chance for a bit of a digression. So if you can bear with me, I will come back to the story. But what's interesting about this to me, especially in light of our discussion yesterday, is that he goes to this teacher because he wants something. He really needs something. I think he's quite desperate. He has leprosy. He thinks that somehow his leprosy is connected with wrongdoing. He wants to be cured. So like many of us, and maybe all of us, he began looking into Zen because he needed help in some way. And that's just fine. Which may seem to contradict my talk from yesterday. Yesterday, during my talk, I talked about expectations. And I talked about wanting something from Zazen. And I encouraged everyone to be aware of their expectations, to really think a little bit about what kind of expectations do I bring? Do I want to fix myself? Do I want to become enlightened? Do I want this or that? And to kind of become familiar with these expectations, hold them a bit and drop them, and just be open to what's here right now. And Zen teachers often talk this way. They often talk in a way that kind of puts down expectations. And they might say, Zazen is good for nothing. Zazen is just a waste of time. Forget all about Zazen being useful. And this causes some consternation. And the question that might arise is, well, if Zazen is not useful, why am I doing it? What's the point? Well, that's a good question. That's a good question. And I think the answer is there are expectations, and then again, there are expectations. There is the world of the absolute, the world of no self, the world of interdependence, the world beyond distinctions, the world of no Ted. I like to talk about this world a lot. How could there be a Ted when everything is interdependent? How could there be a lake? These are just abstract ideas we come up with. We're dividing the world into little pieces because it's easy to understand. But that's not the world. These things are not distinct. These things do not exist independently. They only exist interdependently. And a lot of our suffering comes from not seeing the interdependence and focusing on one part of the world without thinking about the rest of it. On the other hand, there's this world of the relative, of the self and of separateness, and that's the world of distinctions. That's the world in which Ted functions, the world where he gives a Dharma talk, the world that most of us are concerned with a lot of the time. Now, these two worlds are really the same. They're really not different. And Zen practice is about letting them be the same. And in practice, in ritual, in various forms of practice, they can come together. The interdependent world, the dependent world, it's all here, no difference. But to our minds, they sure do look different a lot of the time. And in this practical world in which we function, expectations and goals are a helpful thing, and they're okay. If some kind of need brings a person to Zen and gets them in the door, that's just great. And if you have an idea of how Zen might help you, excuse me, and if you have a plan, that's great too. In a sense, any kind of vow you make is a plan. I vow to sit every day, or something like that. We are setting up an expectation when we do that. That motivates us, and it frees us up. It prevents us from having to sort of reinvent our approach to our practice every day. Probably good to reinvent it now and then, maybe fairly frequently, but not every day, not every single day. So why do I and other teachers talk all the time about dropping all expectations? I think it's because when it comes down to it, when it really comes down to it, when you're sitting on the cushion, when you're doing the practice, those expectations and plans and vows can't really help. They can't really help us to see this world of interdependence. Expectations may bring you to the cushion, and that's great, but once you're there, once you're sitting and engaged in Zazen, you can't have your plan in mind. It is not helpful. If you're sitting and you're thinking about your goal, you can't really be present on your cushion. To really break through, to find the real quiet, it can only be now. And if you're holding an idea of how things are going to be, or how things should be different, or how you need to be different, there's this idea between you and things, and you cannot let things in. Like, yesterday I was talking about pulling weeds, and there are two ways to pull weeds. One way to pull weeds is to keep the goal in mind. You may look at the path, and you need to weed the whole path, and you keep that goal in mind of weeding the whole path. So each time you pull a weed, it's kind of in service of that goal. And keeping that goal in mind may help you to get it done faster, because you're not lost in this sort of one moment of wow, it's a weed. Great, you know, you don't have time for that. You got to get the path done. The other way is to just pull the weed. You know, just focus on that individual weed. Let the thoughts of what you need to get done go. And that's usually how we weed here, which is why the path still has weeds in it. Even though we had about 8 people out there yesterday. I didn't know when I started talking about weeds that for work practice we'd all be assigned to weeding the path. That was really fortuitous. But, you know, one weed at a time. You can pull one weed at a time. And you're kind of afraid to do that. That seems really risky, because if you just put everything you have into that one weed and forget your whole body and mind, you're going to forget the rest of your project, and you're not going to get it done, and you may forget the rest of your life, and you're going to be in big trouble. You got to keep all that stuff here all the time. But I'm saying, you know, take the risk. Pull the weed. Let it all go and see what happens. Will it still be there after you've pulled the weed? I think it will. I think so. Take the risk. So expectations is actually as important as no expectations, right? You do need to get the job done. You do need to get the path weeded. No expectations is important. You need to be present with it. You want to enjoy it, right? You want to be present. You want to be doing this job. They're equally important, but Zen teachers tend to really emphasize the no expectations. That's what we talk about all the time. Because we, as human beings, we know all about expectations. We know all about how to bring all that stuff to the moment and spur ourselves on to get the work done, because we have these goals and things like that. But we don't know as much about dropping expectations, which is why we emphasize that part of it. So please, if you're sitting on your cushion today, if you're in retreat, or tomorrow or the next day, please, when you're sitting on your cushion, don't think about what Zazen might do for you. Save that for another time. There's an appropriate time to do that. On the cushion, just do the practice. Follow your breath. When thoughts come, hold them. Let things be. Just let things come. Let things come. Not, I'm sitting here because I need to become a different person. You know? No, it's, who am I now? Who am I now? What is it now? What is it now? So, that's a little bit about expectations. So back to the story. So Sung-san again, he says, my body is infected with leprosy. I beg you, O priest, to cleanse me of my wrongdoing. So, he seems to think that his physical state results from some kind of wrongdoing. I doubt it. I don't think leprosy is caused by bad karma. I don't really know the point of this story. Does he really have leprosy? Is that a detail that was maybe added later to kind of bring in a physical manifestation of this emotional state that he has. I really don't know. Maybe it's just an enhancement. But at any rate, Daizu Hueka replies, "Bring me your wrongdoing, and I will cleanse you." And I think this is a little like saying, show me your separate self. Show me this person who has the bad karma. Who is it that's dragging this body around for you? Show me this person. And Sung San paused a bit and he said, when I look for my wrongdoing, I cannot find it. And Daizu Hueka says, I have already cleansed you of your wrongdoing. You must rely on the Buddha, Dharma, and community of believers. And Sung Song gets it. He has come to the second ancestor. He's caught in his expectations. He's caught in his need to be cured and his sense that he has been defined by his past. His wrongdoing brought him here. The second ancestor basically says, that was then, this is now, that doesn't matter. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, just do the practice. Your wrongdoing is no longer here. It is not relevant at this time. And there's a somewhat similar story of Sung San and his successor, the fourth ancestor, whose name was Dayi Daoxin. And this is in Zen's Chinese Heritage by Andy Ferguson. So now Sung San has been teaching, and the novice monk Daoxin comes to him, comes to pay his respects to him. And he says, I ask for the master's compassion. Please tell me of the gate of emancipation. It's a little bit like the leprosy and the wrongdoing. I think he's caught in this idea that there's emancipation and there's non-emancipation, that these are two different things. And that's fine. This little dilemma, it got him here. It got him to seek out the teacher. But now the teacher is going to try to disabuse him of this notion. And Sung San says, who has bound you? And Daoxin says, no one has bound me. And Sung San says, then why are you seeking emancipation? And at this point, Daoxin achieved great enlightenment. And I didn't mention Daoxin is 14 years old when this happens. So it took four sentences. Those were the days. It was. It tends to take a little longer now for most people. It tends to be a little bit of work involved. No one has bound me. Then why are you seeking emancipation? So Daoxin makes him his follower, and eventually he gives him Dharma transmission. And he writes a poem, or Sung San writes a poem. He says, the flowers are planted when the ground is ready. This is about the transmission. And part of that might be sort of when the student is ready, the teacher appears. But also, I think the flowers are planted when the ground is ready. Usually some work precedes this sort of moment of enlightenment. And for Daoxin, he got it right away. No one has bound me. But for most of us, this is a process of becoming intimate with our bindings, I think. Who has bound us? We think we're bound. In a lot of ways, we bind ourselves. We bind ourselves. And we learn how we do that. And in sitting, we spend a lot of time with our expectations, with our ideas of who we are, with our ideas of how we might be limited. And these are our bindings. And they come up. We see them. Sometimes we've been carrying these around for years and we don't know about it. And they come up, which is why this practice can be pretty surprising. These things come up and we begin to see them. And sometimes there's some discomfort in that, but when they come up and we begin to see them, they begin to, you know, lose their power a little bit. They begin to evaporate sometimes. From this planting, the flower blooms. the student is free. If no one plants the seed, the flowers and ground are both extinguished, which could be taken in different ways, but one thing about that, I think, is it's stressing the importance of the teacher. The teacher is very important in Zen. And I think coming to this community, you can see that there are a lot of teachers and a lot of ways to learn, and that's really great. And having multiple teachers can be really great. But eventually, I think choosing one teacher can be a very helpful thing. Stacy, could you turn that clock? Thank you. So who has bound you? Sometimes we bind ourselves. I wrote a story about a young man I was working with who had a lot of great difficulties. And we were engaged in a creative writing project. And at first he only wrote about his pain, how much everything hurt. He had some serious difficulties. And after a while he began to write about other things. And he wrote this one piece which I thought was really crucial, and I think it was entitled Safety in This Chamber. And he wrote about how he has what he called chambers. And these were things that troubled him, depression, suicidal thoughts, things like that. He says he spends time in his chambers and he feels safe there. That although these are incredibly unpleasant things, there's some comfort in being there because he knows what to expect. Because this is kind of habitual. He can come back to these places and it's like, yeah, I know this. I know this. I know how to be here. Somehow there's something easy about that. And I think him recognizing that, him getting outside of that situation enough to see it, that he kind of keeps himself there. He's kind of keeping himself there, that no one has bound him, that he has, in a sense, bound himself. He has become intimate with his bindings. And when he became intimate with those bindings, he started writing about other things, and things got a lot better. And it took a long time. It wasn't instant, but things got a lot better. Who has bound you? So back to Sungsan. That's about all we know about him, what I've said. That's pretty much everything, except for one other thing, which is something that draws me over and over to him. And that is a poem that is attributed to him called Faith in Mind, or Affirming Faith in Mind. And I think it contains the essence of Zen in so few words. And it's beautifully written. I come back to it again and again. He may have written it. We really don't know. It may have been composed much later. Dumoulin, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, says it's one of the strongest expressions of Chinese Zen. He says there is a Taoist influence evident in the lyricism of the verses. He says also evident are the Mahayana notions of emptiness and ultimate unity beyond all opposites, for you scholars. The translation I use is, it's in the Northfield Buddhist Meditation Chant Book, Buddhist Meditation Center Chant Book. And this came from, it was on a card I received from my first Zen temple, the Ann Arbor Zen Temple. And I love this translation because it's really beautiful and it's really chantable. And it starts out, the great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. And I talked about this yesterday, and I said, I think that's all we need. That's all we need for this session if we're looking for some guidance. The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. It's so simple. It's so simple. I almost don't want to add to it at all. I don't want to say anything, but you came here for a talk, so. The great way. So the great way is the great way, the way of the Buddhas and ancestors. We have these Buddhas and ancestors. We have this tradition. We have the tradition of our own center here. We have things we do like sewing robes and sewing rakusus. We have our chanting and our bowing and all of these things that help us with the practice. That's the great way. That's the great way. At least that brings us to the practice. It's an expression of the practice. When it comes down to it, the great way is the thing that all of that is pointing to, which is just this, which is just this moment, just this being right now. That's the great way. That's the great way. We come to our cushion with this idea of tradition and teaching and the 1,000 books in the library. And when we sit on the cushion, it's good to forget all that stuff and just ask, what does it feel like to be here right now? What does it feel like to be in this body? That question, sincerely asked, is worth reading 1,000 books. So, the great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. So, what is picking and choosing? Picking and choosing, that's, you know, our conventional way of looking at things, bringing analysis to things, bringing thoughts to things. We have such habit energy, which you tend to see when you go into retreat, when you're kind of watching your mind. This forward propulsion is like, I have to grab this, I have to grab that. I need to figure this thing out. I need to keep busy. If I don't keep busy, something is bad is going to happen. I can't pay attention to this weed. I've got all those other weeds. It's amazing how kind of constant that is. That's picking and choosing. Not picking and choosing, stepping back, letting all things come, being here in our mindfulness practice, our walking meditation, just letting things be. Not reaching. It's so hard not to reach because we do it all the time. We're always grasping. Well, what about that? You know, what can I do about that? It's not about what we can do about that. It's not about that. It's the backward step. And the great way is not difficult. By definition, the great way cannot be difficult. Because the great way is simply not picking and choosing. It's about letting things be. It's an absence of effort. It's a giving up of the striving. It's a kind of ease. It's a kind of repose. So it's not difficult. It doesn't have to be difficult. But this idea of difficulty also has a dual nature, as you may have guessed. I mean, obviously Zen practice is difficult in many ways. We've been sitting here, some of us, together for quite a long time now, and it takes a lot of focus. And I think every person here is challenged by this practice. It can be physically uncomfortable. It can be uncomfortable to be alone with your thoughts. You can get tired. There can be times of great ease as well. There can be really wonderful moments. There could be times when everything just sort of comes together so beautifully. The way we relate to each other in the Zendo, just by using great care as to how we approach one another, it can be just beautiful. But no one would deny that this is kind of hard work. So the great way is not difficult does not mean that Zen practice will always be easy. It doesn't mean that if it's hard for you, you're doing it wrong. It means that you do the work. You have to do the work. You have to prepare the ground. You have to sit. You have to become intimate with your bindings. But ultimately, it's about letting go. It's about letting go, letting it be. And in saying it's not difficult, I'm challenging you a little bit. So that hopefully you won't always view Zen practice as pure discipline, as just this hard work, as just this again and again and again, I have to go back to making myself do this or that. You know, when the time comes, you just let go. You just let go. When the time comes, when it's appropriate, and you know when that is. And sometimes your very first sitting, you may get a glimpse of that I can just let go. I can just let it be. Or maybe you'll get that after many sittings. Or maybe it doesn't seem to happen. But you never know when it's going to happen, and don't be limited by your ideas of what has happened before. For Dao Xin, it happened after four sentences. For you, it may take a little longer, but stick with it. Open yourself again and again. Don't believe that what happened yesterday is going to define what happens today. Don't believe that the last weed has something to do with this weed. Just pull this weed. Just open yourself. Sometimes just a little bit of naive letting go is okay. Like well, I almost said a bad word here. But I don't do that. I don't do that in the Zendo. But it was a two-word expression. The second word was it. So this goes on, and it's just beautiful. And I feel like it kind of says the same thing again and again. In different ways. The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. When preferences are cast aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. But even slight distinctions made set earth and heaven far apart. I think of when one is in a place of quiet beyond distinctions, when one hasn't brought ideas into the situation to sort of mess up the experience of it, it's so easy to lose that. You become quiet and things come and you see nature in a new way and it's just vivid and it's wonderful and you want to go woohoo, you know, and you go woohoo and it's gone. It's gone again. So yeah. It's sort of like climbing to the top of the mountain, you know. I've climbed some little bitty mountains, and I've watched movies about people climbing really big mountains, you know. And it seems like they get to the top, and the common reaction is like, yes, I did it, I conquered the world, woohoo, you know. And it surprises me. I would think a little bit of sort of humility at the top of the mountain would be good and might help one to be a little more vividly there. So, because we don't want to hold the joy too much. We want to feel the joy. You know, we really want to thoroughly feel the joy of this practice. But not go over it again and again. Not exult in it, you know, because that interferes with our present practice. But the good news about that is we don't want to hold on to the sorrow either, right? We feel the sorrow and then we let it go. And we go on to the next thing. To founder in dislike and like is nothing but the mind's disease. And not to see the way's deep truth disturbs the mind's essential peace. Our natural state is peace. The way is perfect like vast space, where there's no lack and no excess. Our choice to choose and to reject prevents our seeing this simple truth. Both striving for the outer world as well as for the inner void, condemn us to entangled lives. Just calmly see that all in one, and by themselves, false views will go. Just calmly, they'll go by themselves. It may not seem like it sometimes, but just relaxing sometimes. Just relaxing into this practice can be a really beautiful thing. So do not ignore that when it comes up. You know, discipline is great. We need discipline in Zen. But don't get too stuck on that discipline. Don't get too stuck on that discipline. And I think that's what I have to say. And I wonder, are there any questions or comments this morning? If not, that's okay, but let's sit for a moment and see if anything comes up. Okay. Okay, well, thank you so much, everyone, for your kind attention this morning.